hour. Then for Sunday, partly sunny, a high of 44 as the temperature peels back a bit. Still windy, at least in the morning, but winds will decrease in the afternoon. The five-day forecast calls for colder weather for next week, with snow and freezing rain Sunday night into Monday. Right now, we've got mostly sunny skies, a temperature reading of 32. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. If you consulted the schedule published in the paper, you might be expecting me to be speaking today about the book Loserville, A Look at Professional Sports in Atlanta, Georgia. That interview is going to actually air next Friday. Instead, we have something very, very special today. I could not be more excited to have in our studios one of the country's leading scholars on the religion of Islam. His name is Professor Amir Hussein, and he is a professor of theological studies and I believe maybe chair of theological studies at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles, a Jesuit university. He is author of the book Muslims and the Making of America, president-elect of the American Academy of Religion, and he has also served as an advisor to several different television programs on various religious topics. But more to the point, he is in southeastern Wisconsin to headline the third Kenosha Interfaith Scholar in Residence program. And he has already given one public address and has several more that are going to be coming up, including later today speaking on the topic of Muslim and media images. And he is in our studios today along with the person serving, in a sense, as his faculty host at Carthage. And this would be Professor Fatih Habsi, associate professor and, I think, chair of the religion department at Carthage College. And Professor Habsi has been on the morning show on a couple of previous occasions, and we're happy that he can be with us this morning as well. Professor Fatih Habsi and Professor Amir Hussein, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Good morning, Greg. It's a delight to be here with you.
Thanks so much, Greg.
So good to have both of you here. Professor Habsi, I was just thinking about this today, and this relates to Professor Hussein as well. It isn't all that long ago. I mean, it's decades ago, but it's not all that long ago that in order for somebody to teach at Carthage College, most likely they would have to be Lutheran. I mean, that would be the expectation. I happen to be Lutheran myself, but of course I'm teaching at Carthage now for all kinds of other reasons, and I don't think at any step along the way did anybody ask if I was Lutheran. And here we are in the year 2022, and not only is a Muslim teaching at Carthage and a cherished part of the community, but chairman of the religion department. And Professor Hussein, you have that distinction as well at this Jesuit university in Los Angeles. I wonder if any of you are kind of struck by that, and maybe that is something that we should not be taking for granted or letting it go without saying.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, sir. It's a really nice change. So I came to Loyola Marymount University, which is a Jesuit university, in 2005. I taught in the Cal State system. I'd grown up in Canada, did my PhD at the University of Toronto, large public state school, went to Cal State Northridge, large public state school, loved being there, except the funding cuts, you know, state of California budget was going up and down, a lot of students, fewer resources for them. You're always worried about the humanities. And so thinking at, you know, at the Jesuit school, I'm never going to have to explain to my then president, Father Bob Lawton, a Jesuit priest, or my then dean, Father Mike Ng, a Jesuit priest, why the study of religion is important. You know, the Jesuits get that.
Right.
And so I was hired in 2005. I got tenured and promoted to full professor in 2009. And that's to your point. That was the first time that someone who was not a Christian was tenured in the theology department. And a couple of years ago became chair of the department. I think that reflects the ethos of the place to say, look, we value the last line of our mission statement is the service of faith and the promotion of justice. Not the holy Catholic faith, not the one true faith, the service of faith. And that the fact that, you know, the university is a Catholic Jesuit school welcomes people from all over. So my current dean now is a woman, Robin Crabtree, who's Jewish. And so the fact that you've got, you know, a Jewish woman who's the dean of a Muslim who's the chair of the theology department, I think really speaks to the inclusivity and the welcoming of the place.
Professor Harpsey, I trust you've experienced at least something of the same thing at Carthage.
Definitely, Greg. And just so you know, there are Lutheran institutions and the universities that is still a requirement to be a Lutheran or a Christian at least to teach, such as Concordia Universities. So being an ELCA tradition, right, coming from the ELCA tradition, Carthage doesn't have such a requirement, not anymore. And we are expected to teach religions all, not just our own expertise, area of expertise. So even though I am a Muslim, a practicing Muslim, I do teach Islam. That's what my PhD was on. But again, I am teaching in my religion courses, Religion 1000 courses, other religions as well, Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism, all the major world religions that you can think of. So I think, you know, the religious background, your religious background does not matter in that sense. You know, what do you know? What can you teach about religion? I think that's what matters in our department.
Right. And teaching about all of them in respectful fashion. Yeah. Before we speak more to Professor Hussein about his own story and the kind of things he's exploring and sharing this weekend, Professor Harpsey, maybe you could say something about the Interfaith Scholar in Residence program. I think this is the third, and maybe you could give us a little background on how this began. I understand it was, in a sense, the idea of somebody who recently passed away, and I think this time around all the events are dedicated to his memory.
Yes, that's correct. Thanks so much, Greg. And that was Rabbi Michael Ramzan. So the Kenosha Interfaith Scholar in Residence, this started in 2014. A couple of congregations, Beth Hillel Temple, a Jewish Reform congregation, First United Methodist Church by the Sheridan Road, Holy Rosary, the Catholic Church, and a couple of people from the Carthage College, they did gather together and they thought, what can we do to the community? Right? What can we, how can we impact our own Kenosha community? So the idea was that let's bring a well-known scholar and let them share their knowledge on a specific tradition at different venues and at different congregations in connection to those congregations and venues. So the first speaker was Amy Jill Levine in 2016. So she was a Jewish scholar. And then 2018, we did bring Mark, I want to say Mark Cownell from Chicago. So he was the Christian scholar. We wanted to bring another scholar in 2020. Guess what happened? You know, the COVID, everything was canceled. So the idea was that, you know, let's bring a Muslim scholar this time. And the American Albanian Islamic Center, the mosque in Kenosha, they were not a part of the interfaith group initially. So they became a part of the interfaith scholar residence in residence program. So we decided to bring a well-known Muslim scholar, and Amir Hussein was that scholar. So we did. He did speak at Carthage last night on anti-racism and American Muslims. He will be speaking at the mosque today at 7 p.m. Muslim and media images, as you mentioned. Tomorrow at the synagogue, and on Sunday at the First United Methodist Church.
Excellent. They are keeping you busy and out of trouble. Very good. So glad that you can be with us. One of the things I wanted to ask you, I didn't know for a fact, but I kind of assumed, gleaned from your biography, that you were from Canada originally. We don't think of Canada necessarily as a stronghold of the Islamic faith. Tell us a little bit about growing up in Toronto and what kind of Islamic community there was and what it felt like to be a Muslim in a nation like Canada.
Yeah, thank you for that, Greg. And so I was born in Pakistan, came to Canada when I was 4 years old. And at that time, Toronto, which is now this major metropolitan, cosmopolitan city, Toronto in 1970, when we came to Canada, was a British city. It was like 85% British, not 85% white, 85% British. So you as like a Lutheran would be the exotic other. Forget about, you know, a black person or, you know, anyone else there. The Muslim population in Canada then was just under 30,000. You know, fast forward 50 years later, and the Muslim population in Canada is over 1.1 million. So Islam is now one of the largest religions in Canada. It's a distant second to, you know, there's like 20 million Canadian Christians. And so when you talk about 1 million Muslims, that's still, you know, literally, you know, 1/20th of the Christian population, but a significant growth. And so as a kid, you know, you didn't have much of an exposure because there was one mosque in the city. That wasn't anywhere close to where we lived. Both my parents worked. I came from a working class background. And so there was no ability to go Friday prayer because A, both your parents worked, B, you were in school, and C, you know, the mosque is a car ride away and you don't have a car, sort of thing. And so you do the kinds of stuff at home. Over the decades, and you know, Canada being part of like the old British Empire, the Commonwealth, that's where you had immigration from South Asia, so people like me from Pakistan, India, from East Africa, that, you know, Tanzania, Kenya, Uganda, you know, those kinds of places. That's what's really, you know, built up the Muslim population, so that now in the city of Toronto, I think there's like 35 mosques. So when I was growing up, there's one. Now there's 30. So there's been a huge growth there of Islam and Muslims.
When you were one of a very few Muslims, what did that feel like, for instance, in school or on your baseball team or wherever? I mean, to what extent did you feel like an outsider, and at the risk of making vast generalizations, what was Toronto like, I mean, in terms of a welcoming place?
No, and that's where Toronto has really shifted, and it comes not without a lot of pain. You know, like to, as I said, to go from a city that in 50 years was 85% British to a city that's now 60% non-white, you know, huge sorts of changes. And that comes with some struggle. That comes with, you know, some racism, some other kinds of things there. But Dr. Harpchi was talking about, you know, tomorrow I'll be speaking at the synagogue. And that goes to your point, Greg, that, you know, as a Muslim kid growing up, it was being in a minority. So you resonated with the Jewish kids, you know. Weren't a whole lot of those either, you know, there. But you learned about Christianity. You learned about the dominant tradition. I grew up in a Canada in the 1970s where we said the Lord's Prayer in the morning. You know, that was part of opening exercise.
And
that's
in school?
In public school. In a public school.
Wow.
You said the Lord's Prayer. In a public school, you know, we had a Christmas pageant. You're a music teacher. Our music at Christmas was Christmas carols. And so, you know, to this day when I'm in the church, you know, over Christmas, because I love, you know, that kind of thing, and we have a wonderful choir at LMU, you know, the students are looking at me and going, wait, how come the Muslim guy is singing the Christmas carols, and how come he's not using the hymnal, and how come he knows like the third verse to Away in a Manger?
Wow.
Like, I learned that when I was a kid, and that's, you know, so when you're a minority, you learn the dominant religious tradition, you know. I didn't learn much about my own Islam until I went to university and took a university course, which happens. I mean, it's the same thing, I suspect, at Carthage College, where you may grow up, let's say, in the Lutheran Church. But do you know the history of the Lutheran tradition? Do you know where that connects with the Catholic tradition? You understand the differences between Reform and Orthodox, you know, all those, until you get to school and study it. That's where you learn. So it's a very different experience. I contrast that, you know, with my nephews, who've grown up in a world in which, you know, you can buy halal food in the local supermarket. You know, that just wasn't a thing when I was growing up. You know, the fact that you see women in hijab, you know, the traditional sort of covering, walking around, and no one thinks about it. It's not the exotic other that it was in 1970.
I heard you say, or I read that you wrote, one of the two, you described Los Angeles, which is now where you live and work, as the most religiously diverse city in the world. I think you said that some years ago. I would assume that that is still the case or largely the case. But I'm just curious what would lead you to say that. I mean, in what way is Los Angeles that? Yeah. The most religiously diverse city in the world.
The most religiously diverse city in the world for a couple of reasons. You know, one is you have such a large population, so you have different communities and different ethnic communities. And so this may surprise some people when I say, you know, the best place in the world to study Buddhism is Los Angeles. That doesn't mean that LA is a majority Buddhist city. It is not. It's a majority Catholic city. You know, it's a funny kind of thing. The largest religious population in Los Angeles, not surprisingly, is Catholics. The Archdiocese of Los Angeles is the largest archdiocese in North America. You know, in America, I think Mexico City is actually larger. The second largest religious population in Los Angeles is lapsed Catholics. You know, that's how big the Catholic population is. Before you get to Jews, Muslims, right. Hindus, Catholics, lapsed Catholics, then, you know, Protestants, that kind of thing. Right. But what I was saying about the Buddhists is that every single type of Buddhist community is found in Los Angeles. So I can take you to this kind of Theravada Buddhist temple. I can take you to this, you know, Sri Lankan Theravada school. I can take you to this Chinese school. I can take you to this Japanese form. Here's this Tibetan form. So all the different forms that Buddhism takes, because of the huge immigrant populations, you may have a small community of maybe 500 people from this particular place where this particular kind of Buddhism is found, but it's going to be there in Los Angeles. You know, it's the second largest Jewish population after New York City. You know, it's probably the second largest Muslim population after New York City. It's scattered because, you know, greater LA is one of these bizarre things. Like the city of Los Angeles itself is about 3.5 million people. But if you ask how many people live within an hour's drive and you wonder why LA traffic is so bad, that's 12 million people. Mm. You've got this huge population, you know, that is in that area with all those different religious traditions. So not technically in Los Angeles, but like in Orange County, just the county to the south of us, is a Cham Muslim population. Like, we don't think about the Cham people who are like in Cambodia, Laos, who after the Vietnam War sort of came here to the United States. And there's a community of about 500 of these Cham Muslims. And I remember going there in 1997 and thinking, wait, Vietnam, Laos, Buddhists? There's no Buddhists there. And they're like, no, they're Buddhists who've been there. And here's like a community of 400 or 500 people there. So that's where the religious diversity of Los Angeles really shows.
Wow. For those of you just joining us, my special guest in the morning show today is Professor Amir Hussain, a professor of theological studies at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles, and he is here in Kenosha over this weekend as the third Kenosha Interfaith Scholar in Residence. Also with us in the studio today, Dr. Fatih Habsi, who is chair of the religion department at Carthage College. Professor Hussain is giving a number of different talks related to Islam. He gave the first one last night, and several more are coming, including one tonight at 7 o'clock at the American Albanian Islamic Center. So, Professor Hussain, by and large, what would you say is the single, or maybe you don't have to limit yourself to one, but let's start with the single most serious misunderstanding that Americans tend to have about Islam and about Muslims?
So, but I think, unfortunately, post 9/11, you know, the typical stereotype that you have is Muslims are violent, or that the Quran is a text of violence. And you want to say, have you read the Bible? Because there's some violence, you know, in that tradition as well. But of course, we know how to read our own texts. We don't know how to read other people's texts. And we know when our own texts are being literal and our own texts are being metaphorical. But we look at other people's texts. So that's one thing. I think the second thing is we don't recognize the diversity of Muslims. You know, it's the second largest religion after Christianity, you know. And so you think about, you talked about Carthage College, the Lutheran community. It's like, okay, well, Lutherans, you mean Evangelical Lutheran Church or Missouri Synod Lutheran? You mean Finnish Lutherans or Swedish Lutherans? Like, you know, all the kind, and that's just within the Lutheran tradition. Imagine 1.5 billion Muslims. So that there's that part. I think here in the U.S., one of the other misconceptions, and the book that I'll be talking about, Muslims in the Making of America, deliberately starts with a very provocative sentence. It starts with a sentence, there has never been an America without Muslims. You know, we tend to think of Islam as a new religion here in the United States, and in some ways it is. You know, both Dr. Harpchi and I are Americans, but we're immigrants to this country. You know, many Muslims came after 1965, after changes that came to immigration law with civil rights law. But we forget the history of Islam in this country, and that goes back to the slave trade. You know, I remember watching Roots, you know, Alex Haley's memoir, 1977, with, you know, LeVar Burton playing Kunta Kinte. And so here's Alex Haley tracing back his ancestry, and the oldest he can go back to is this slave who's brought to Annapolis, Maryland, Kunta Kinte, who's Muslim. And I'm like, wait, there were Muslims who were slaves? And then you think, oh, well, of course, you know, Islam has been to West Africa since the 9th century. Much easier to bring slaves from West Africa than from East Africa. And so we estimate that about 10% of the slaves that were brought over were Muslim. And so there's this history. It goes back to – we're almost – and this will surprise some people – almost at the 500th anniversary of Muslims in this country, because the first Muslim that we can document, you know, we have evidence for, is a slave who was brought over by one of the Spanish conquistadors, Estevanico, Estevancio, little Stephen, the Moor, 1528.
Wow.
You know, and you think about that. And so I think that misconception, no, we've been here in this country
for 250 years before the Declaration of Independence. Speaking of the Declaration of Independence, I know one of the things you touch on in your book is that Thomas Jefferson had a pretty close acquaintance with the Quran. I think you also say in your book, I wrote it down. He. It is not that he was a fan of Islam, but nevertheless, he had a deep acquaintance. What was it that led Jefferson to want to make that exploration?
So that's a perfect example, Greg. You know, Mr. Jefferson, amazing person. You know, when you write the Virginia Statute of Religious Freedom that becomes the First Amendment, when you write the Declaration of Independence, you know, that's astonishing. You know, here. But as a comparativist, for him, he knew European law. He knew English and French law. When you're coming up with this text that's going to define our country, to have a comparative perspective. So the other legal system that, of course, he was aware of but didn't know much about was the Islamic system, you know. And so Mr. Jefferson in 1765, before this country, before 1776, gets a copy of the Quran. It's George Sales's English translation. That's now in the Library of Congress. You know, that's one of those funny moments of the Library of Congress started off as Mr. Jefferson's private library that he sold to the government. Very smart man, because he sold that library for $28,000. You're thinking, wait, what was $28,000 like in the 1800s worth, you know, right. there? But the fact that he bought a copy of the Quran. Now, as I say, you know, Mr. Jefferson was no fan of Islam. He was not interested at all in becoming Muslim. I would say that Mr. Jefferson had some issues with religion. If you look at Mr. Jefferson's Bible, you know, he had his own sort of cut and paste of the pieces that he liked. But he wanted to learn about Islam. And then it goes even deeper. He begins to realize, oh, okay, well, I'm reading the Quran. Well, that's the English translation. You know, how do Muslims understand this? Maybe I should learn Arabic. Now, he doesn't have any Arabic tutors. Surprise, surprise. There's no Arabic tutors in colonial America. But Mr. Jefferson is one of these, you know, intellectual giants where he's got a copy bilingual of Galen, the Greek physician, in Greek and Arabic. And of course, as an educated man in the classics, he can read the Greek. So he tries to teach himself the Arabic from the Greek. And think about that for a second, that you're trying to teach yourself one language from another language. It's not the language that you speak. And so when Mr. Jefferson, and I'll stop here, you know, created the Virginia Statute, when we talk about freedom of religion, you know, we mistakenly think freedom of religion is about Christians, that, you know, Baptists and Methodists or Catholics, you know, have the right to do what they want to do. And for Mr. Jefferson, and he wrote this in his, what was it, 1821 autobiography, that no, religious freedom is religious freedom. It extends to the Hindu, the infidel, he used the term Mohammedan, you know, as opposed to Muslim. But this idea that if we're going to have religious freedom, it's for everyone. It's not just for Christians, and which is extraordinary when you think about where the world was in the 19th century.
That was probably a novel / shocking proposition in the minds of a whole lot of people. Yeah. Tells us a lot about Thomas Jefferson and how he was wired. I know that your book goes on to really explore a lot of other ways in which Muslims have been major players in the development of our country, and in particular, you point to a number of notable Muslims who made contributions that that nowadays are largely forgotten. Yeah. Are there one or two that you want to highlight for us?
Absolutely, and so one of the things about the book that, you know, I tried to do was make it easy and simple to read, and for a lot of people saying, well, you know, Muslims haven't contributed much to America, and you want to say, okay, well, let's see who we're talking about, and so let me just talk about the two men I dedicate the book to. The first one all your listeners should know, and that's Muhammad Ali, you know. 2016 death, state funeral, you know, President Clinton, other people spoke there. If you watch the Ken Burns documentary that just came out, the new documentary on Muhammad Ali, what I love about that documentary is he really talks about Ali's conversion to Islam through the Nation of Islam, his social justice work, you know. In 1967, when Muhammad Ali refuses induction into the draft for the Vietnam War, he's reviled because opposing the war in 67 is a terrible thing. You know, Dr. King opposes the war in 67, and he's reviled, you know. 73, all of a sudden, we could say, hey, maybe this war is not such a great idea, but 67, you know, you couldn't do this. And so you look at someone like Muhammad Ali, arguably, at the time of his death, the most famous man in the world. That, you know, I have a dear friend, Gary Smith, who wrote for Sports Illustrated, is now sort of retired, but he's written a number of pieces about Ali in Sports Illustrated. And he says, what must it be like to be Muhammad Ali, where you can walk down any street in any city in the world and people know who you are? And this is before the internet. This is before all that kind of stuff. So Muhammad Ali, and we think about, oh, yeah, that guy was an American Muslim. The one that people don't know, you'll know him, and Dr. Harpshi will know him, is Ahmet Erdogan, you know, chairman of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, you know, the founder of Atlantic Records. And I will say this, you know, publicly, that I don't think you can understand the history of America in the 20th century without paying attention to Atlantic Records. Not the history of American music, the history of America. That here's this Turkish Muslim guy who comes to America because his father is like the second ambassador from the Turkish Republic to the United States. So he's in D.C. He goes to school at St. John's College in Annapolis. His father dies. He's got to decide if he's going to go back to Turkey or is he going to stay in America. He decides to stay in America. Wonderful Muslim-Jewish story, you know, with his Jewish friend and a loan from their dentist, they start Atlantic Records in the 1940s. They work with a lot of the race-based kind of music, you know, because America in the 1940s, even in D.C., is segregated, you know. He likes going into the black neighborhoods near Howard just because he loves the music, you know. He'd listen to Ella Fitzgerald in London when his dad was the ambassador to – a Turkish ambassador to London before he became the Turkish ambassador to the U.S. They signed Ray Charles to Atlantic Records. You know, all those great R&B sides of the 60s, the soul sides in the 70s, he signs Led Zeppelin to Atlantic Records. Rolling Stones Records is distributed to Atlantic Records. You know, he dies basically at a Rolling Stones concert, you know, at the Beacon Theater in New York, because he's sort of backstage, you know, with Mick and Keith, which is never a good idea, and falls and hits his head and doesn't regain consciousness. But the fact that this Turkish-American Muslim guy and his father and his grandfather was involved in one of the big Sufi orders in Turkey, he's taken back to be buried in Turkey in the ancestral sort of, you know, plot for this particular religious order. So here's this guy that we don't think about. And yet I don't think we can understand America without Atlantic Records.
Hmm. And, of course, this book of yours, again, titled Muslims and the Making of America, outlines those stories and many, many more, and helps us understand that we should not think of Muslims as kind of an exotic offshoot, marginalized in any way, but a really important part of our country's history. I heard you say in a previous interview, I heard you draw an interesting distinction between the place of Muslims here in America versus the place of Muslims in Europe. And it was a very intriguing contrast that I don't remember ever hearing before. And in a sense, it's a much more central place here in America versus in Europe, where you say Muslims there tend to be much more marginalized and, in a sense, economically in lower classes and so on. Tell us why you think that is. What is it? What is different about here versus there that such a thing should be true?
So thank you for that. That it's a great observation here that if we look at America, you know, America is an extraordinary country. And to be an American doesn't mean to be confined to one particular ethnicity or race or religion. You can be any color, you can be any religion and be an American. And you're welcomed here. I mean, I grew up in Canada. I became a U.S. citizen in 2013. So the fact that, you know, I could become a citizen here. So that's one thing. Second thing is if you look at the American Muslim population, we're just as diverse as America is. You know, a third of us are people like me, South Asians from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh. A third are people like Dr. Harpchi, you know, from the Middle East. And it could be Turkish, it could be Arab, it could be Iranian. At least a quarter, and this is what I was saying earlier, are African American, you know, people who have a long history going back centuries to this country. Los Angeles has this large Latino Muslim population that you wouldn't think about, the Cham Muslim population, all that kind of stuff. So, A, we're ethnically diverse. B, we can be, and this is the great genius of America, that, you know, you're not defined by who your father was. You can be whoever you want to be. You know, we have American Muslims who are among the elite, you know, doctors, lawyers, engineers, business people. I write in the book about Shahid Khan, who owns the Jacksonville Jaguars. Like, you know, you're in the 1% if you're an NFL owner. There's an American Muslim guy who's, you know, in that 1%, you know, American Muslim owners. Then you have people like me who grew up working class. You know, you have people who are on the margins. You have people struggling there. You contrast that with Europe and much tighter identity. What does it mean to be British? Or what does it mean to be French? Or what does it mean to be German? You know, and then you look at the ethnic makeup of the Muslim communities. Not surprisingly, most of the Muslims in Britain, like over 90%, are South Asian, you know, because of the history of the Commonwealth. Most of the Muslims in France are North African because of the French colonial presence, like in Algeria and Tunisia and those places. Most of the Muslims in Germany are Turks. You know, they're guest workers.
And so less diverse than our Islamic population here in America?
Both. You know, the Muslim population is less diverse, and the national population, you know, Germans are much less diverse than America. I mean, we're 400 million people, you know. So there's that part. And, you know, your Turkish guest work in Germany, you're not going to be able to get citizenship in Germany. And so that kind of thing. So I think for American Muslims, precisely because, A, we're able to work here and succeed here and become Americans, you know, in a way that can you really become English without, you know, being white and connected to the Church of England and being born in England. I think that's one of those differences. And what that results in is a lot more marginalization, a lot more economic disparity. You tend not to have, I mean, of course, there are Muslims in Germany and France and the UK who are well off, but the majority tend to be more marginalized and working class in contrast to here in America, where you have, you know, everyone can think of, people will say, well, I don't know any Muslims. I'm like, your doctor probably is a Muslim. There's probably a cardiologist somewhere that you've been treated by who's a Muslim. An engineer that your company might bring in is probably a Muslim. And so you have that kind of class differential.
Mm. You mentioned that you were born in Pakistan. I'm reminded of a story of a Pakistani restaurant in Racine. It's one of my favorite places. And there was an incident a few years back, maybe, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago, where somebody posted kind of a nasty racist comment about, this particular restaurant, and why don't they go back to America where they belong, and so on. I think it was during the height of the war in Afghanistan. And it was turned out to be a tremendously gratifying story because this restaurant is located fairly close to Johnson Wax, and I think it's the very next day there were dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of people who came over from Johnson Wax specifically to patronize this restaurant, which they would do from time to time, but I mean in a very concerted show of support for this family and this wonderful restaurant. And it happened the next day and the next day and the next day. I mean, this long line of people out the door wanting to go out of their way to sort of make the point that one racist comment, that not that there aren't plenty of more people beyond that, but that did not represent this community or what we collectively think about you and you being here. And I suspect along the way you've probably experienced that yourself, or I mean observed that way in which how we respond to those unfortunate statements of ignorance and prejudice that, of course, are still part of the world, even in a place as diverse as the United States.
No, absolutely. And I think that's sort of what always gives me hope is you do have those negative incidents. And you see those across religious traditions. You know, one of the things I'll be talking about tomorrow when I speak to the synagogue is, for all the anti-Muslim violence and rhetoric in this country, the number one hate crime against a religion is still against the Jewish community.
Yeah.
And so you have that kind of thing, which just stuns me, given the Jewish presence, in America and the history. But then the other side of that is precisely as you've described, people saying, no, you may have this abstract concept of Islam out there, but my friend Fatih teaches at the college and my daughter took his class and he's a really good teacher. My daughter had a great experience, in his class. Or my friend runs this restaurant, or my friend Shazia is a doctor who treats my uncle who's a vet. And so here's this Pakistani woman who's treating veterans. What more noble thing could you be doing there? So I think it's exactly that sense of the personal. I think going back to your original question about misconceptions, I think, many people don't know a Muslim. And you want to say, yeah, you probably know a Muslim, but you probably don't know that they're Muslim. Like, I don't know that Dr. Harpshi goes around saying, hey, I'm a Muslim, come pray with me. Or that Dr. Shazia says, hey, I'm a Muslim, come to the masjid with me. It's like, no, you know her because she's a doctor. You know this guy because he's an engineer. You know that guy because he runs the local grocery store. And I think that's the real key. And that for me, again, I have the zeal of a convert as an American citizen. Yeah, that's the great thing about this country is that we're able to be welcome here because of our contributions. That, my allegiance isn't to, a king or a government. It's to a piece of paper. It's the Constitution.
Mm.
That's the real key here.
Yeah. Beautifully said. You're going to be speaking tonight at the American Albanian Islamic Center on the topic of Muslim and media images, and I suspect that behind that title is the unfortunate preponderance of certain depictions of Muslims and the Islamic faith that we often see. First of all, describe in a sense that problem, the dimensions of it, and then what you hope can be done to address it.
And so I think with any kind of minority or marginalized group, oftentimes you get stereotypes, And so when I was a kid growing up, we talked about being in the 70s and 80s, you didn't see a lot of Muslims on TV. Who you saw were sort of terrorists, post-1972 with the Olympics, the whole notion of, Palestinian terrorists and hijacking, and then, the equation of Islam with Arab identity. only about 20% of Muslims are Arabs. You know, neither Dr. Harpreet nor I, who are both Muslims, are Arabs. And so, you know, that sort of synonymous portrayal and the Arab oil sheikh, you know, all that kind of stuff there. And then 1990s, the terrorist, you know, that kind of image. So if all you see on TV is this negative image and you don't see the positive side, of course you're going to have these kinds of negative stereotypes there. So that's I think, one thing there. But the second thing is that you have people now who are starting to change those kinds of images, Muslims who are starting to, you know, do that kind of work. So I'll be talking about some of those folks. But it also happens from other people. So one of the real things that, you know, I never thought I'd do when I moved out to Los Angeles, to start working with folks in the film and television industry. And for 3 years, Mr. Morgan Freeman did a television show called The Story of God with Morgan Freeman. And I was one of the advisors for the 3 years and was, you know, on one of the episodes in the second season. But that was, you know, it was Mr. Freeman's sort of own interest that spurred the show, that he was in Turkey. He was filming one of the Batman films, you know, the Chris Nolan Batman films where he plays like the Lucius Fox character. And Mr. Freeman's a smart man. So, you know, you got a day off from shooting and he wants to sort of see the sights, and he goes to Hagia Sophia, you know, this Byzantine church that was built when Istanbul was Constantinople. Then the Muslims conquer it. It becomes Istanbul. Hagia Sophia, this Orthodox church, becomes a mosque. And so Mr. Freeman is there, you know, getting a tour, and in the dome is this beautiful mosaic of Jesus and Mary. And Morgan Freeman says to his tour guide, well, wait. You told me this was built as an Orthodox church. Yes. Okay, so I understand why there's a mosaic of Jesus and Mary. But then you told me that this had been taken over by the Muslims. Yes, Mr. Freeman. And turned into a mosque. Yes, Mr. Freeman. Well, why would the Muslims leave the image of Jesus and Mary? And the tour guide just turns to him very simply and says, well, Mr. Freeman, Jesus and Mary are important to Muslims. And he just paused for a second and said, oh, I did not know that. Hmm. And then he thought, and this is why I love this man, you know, if I didn't know that, and that's kind of a basic thing about Islam, what else don't I know about religion? And so he just does this, I don't want to say it's a selfish pursuit, but to help him learn about religion. And so that's an example. Like if you watch, and you know, the series has been off the air for a while, so if you watch Story of God with Morgan Freeman, you'll get some pretty interesting portrayals of Islam and Muslims. So I think it's those kinds of things that really help to change that narrative.
Right. And of course, one of the things, unfortunately, we see, I say this as someone who happens to be very religious, that it makes me really sad that you watch a show like Friends or lots of mainstream TV and the presence of religion is very, very scant. And when it's there, I mean, there might be a little whiff of something that's typically related to the Christian faith, maybe to the Jewish, once in a while, Islam, or something else. But I mean, just by and large, religious practice, religious faith tends not to have much of a home in a lot of what we see on our TV screens, especially. And I suppose that's one of the things you'd like to see. And not only that, but that it would be really nice if positive and sensitive portrayals of what it means to be Muslim could be part of the fabric of what entertains us.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. And in your question about, you know, the differences between European context and American context, religion comes into this. You know, for all the talk about the decline of religion, decline of Christianity in America, we're still a religious country. You know, 70% of Americans still believe in God. 60% still say they go to, you know, weekly services. That's completely different from the European context. Like we took students to the Netherlands, you know, maybe 5 years ago. And that was one of the first things we talked about was, hey, like half the Dutch are atheists, you know. So to be a religious person in the Netherlands is to be in the minority. Hmm. To be a religious person in America is to be in the majority. And do we talk about this? And that's where, you know, I teach a class on religion and film. And the first film that I start with, and I've started with it ever since the film came out because I love the film, is Clint Eastwood's Gran Torino, you know. Not because there's a priest who's in there, not because the opening scene is a funeral, but the transformation that happens to Clint Eastwood's Walt Kowalski character. You know, I grew up with a dad who worked in the auto industry. One of the reasons for coming to Kenosha was just to see the space, you know, where the Chrysler plant, you know, used to be. You have all these people who worked in that industry, and you saw the changes, the transformation. what happens to you in that? And so in that sense, a film like Gran Torino is this deeply, deeply religious film, you know, and it's we need more of that kind of understanding that, you know, your religion as a Lutheran isn't just going to church on Sunday. That's part of it. But, you know, you're not in church for, you know, the vast majority of your time. And so how do you live your life as a Lutheran? How do we live our lives as Muslims or as Hindus or Buddhists, you know, where religion is part of the fabric, you know? It's not the key thing. If I reduce my Catholic friends to just going to Mass, that's not an expression of their Catholicism. I mean, of course, that's an expression of the Catholicism, but so is the altar they have to Mary. So is the altar they build for the Day of the Dead. So is this prayer that they say. So is the rosary that they recite at home. You know, like it's all that kind of thing. And I think that's really important. Do we talk more about the real life religious lives of Americans?
Right, the other 6 days of the week. And not to regard it as, I mean, if it ever shows up, it's usually Chandler's strange new girlfriend or something that, or whatever. And it would be nice to see it as a reflection of, as you said, of who we are as a nation. But it's as though those who put together Hollywood's entertainment for the rest of us, you know, perhaps that's not a part of who they are. So they don't understand that it's a part of who we are collectively. I think one of the things you really hope for is that, for instance, the Muslim community, which already has such an important presence in certain aspects of American life, you've outlined some of them, that they might start to become players in what we're talking about here.
Absolutely. And so one of the things I'm really looking forward to tonight, speaking at the Albanian Muslim mosque at the community there, is to say to the Muslim community, look, you know, and this is a connection with the Jewish community. Muslim mothers are Jewish mothers. You know, you have four options as a kid for a career. You can be a doctor, you can be a lawyer, you can be an engineer, you can be a business owner, and there is no fifth option, you know. And you want to say, yeah, I'm not saying we shouldn't have doctors. Yeah, have doctors, have lawyers, engineers. But we need Muslim writers. We need Muslim journalists. We need Muslim radio personalities. We need Muslim actors. We need Muslim directors, you know. That's – if we're going to tell our story, that's how we're going to tell our story, you know. If we leave it to other people to tell our story, why are we surprised when they may not tell it in the kind of way? And, you know, living in L.A., you see this with my actor friends, you know, whether they're black, Latino, Muslim, like, you know, oh, yeah, I could play terrorist number two or gangbanger number three, you know, but is that going to perpetuate a stereotype? But terrorist number three pays me $50,000, so that'll pay for my kids', you know, education. So yeah. Am I going to take that role? And so you have that kind of thing happening. But I think, you know, if you look at people like Rami Youssef, you know, like Mahershala Ali, you know, like Kumail Nanjiani, you know, all of whom are different kinds of Muslims who are doing the kind of work, you watch The Big Sick and you get a sense of, oh, that's what being a Muslim is. It isn't that, it's this. And so, yeah, precisely that's the encouragement to the Muslim community is, you know, are we encouraging our children to go into the arts and to be able to tell our own stories?
Fascinating. And, you know, it just occurred to me now that here we're talking about this, and I'd forgotten all about the fact that you live and work in Los Angeles, and you've been there a long, long time. So in some ways, I should think you're probably even maybe more acutely aware of this particular, let's call it a deficit.
Well, it's the industry. I mean, I think that I say to my students all the time, this is why America is the most powerful country in the world. Not because of our military, even though we have the most powerful military in the world. Not because of our economy, even though we have the most powerful economy and you can use U.S. dollars in, you know, numerous countries. It's our cultural production. Mm. You know, everyone around the world listens to American music, watches American films, reads American books, watches American TV shows like you talked about, Friends. People around the world watch that show, you know. And so that's why we're so powerful is we project that culture, you know. I grew up, as I said, with family who worked in the auto industry. That was Southern Ontario. You know, that was like one in six jobs was connected to the auto industry. Well, Los Angeles, it's film and television. And these huge numbers of people that, you know, we think of a movie and think of the 20 actors. Well, there's more accountants on a film than there are actors on a film, you know. And so how many people work in that industry? And so being able to be connected with that, and people saw this, you know, in terms of money, that, you know, religion really wasn't a big player until Mel Gibson did Passion of the Christ, and that film made $1 billion. And all of a sudden people are thinking, oh, religion, we can make a film about that. That's going to make us money. And so you have that, you know, impetus.
Yeah, interesting. Well, it will be interesting to see where all of this goes. And, of course, in the meantime, this is the topic of your talk tonight at the American Albanian Islamic Center, tonight at 7, Muslims and Media Images. And, of course, you also speak, as we said, at Beth Hillel Temple and at First United Methodist Church later in the weekend. Professor Harpsey, are these events all free and open to the public? Do people need to register to attend or purchase tickets?
There is a pre-registration for the event at the Beth Hillel only on Saturday, but the rest of the events, you know, the event at the mosque today, the event at the church on Sunday, they are all free and open to the public.
Very good. And again, on Sunday, that's First United Methodist Church and Beth Hillel Temple tomorrow. And more information is available at Carthage's website, carthage.edu. Professor Amir Hussein and Professor Fatih Habsi, what a lovely opportunity this has been for me.